In case you're just recently joining us, or however long you've been a listener of the show, you may not realize that we have years and years of incredible episodes in our archives. We've had so many wonderful guests that we've decided to handpick one of our favorites that may be new to you, but if it's not, it's definitely worth another listen. We hope you'll enjoy this episode with Dan Harris.
I wanted to call the book "The Voice in My Head is an Asshole" because I just think that's a profane statement of a fundamental truth.
Welcome to The One You Feed. Throughout time, great thinkers have recognized the importance of the thoughts we have. Quotes like "garbage in, garbage out," or "you are what you think" ring true. And yet, for many of us, our thoughts don't strengthen or empower us. We tend toward negativity, self-pity, jealousy, or fear. We see what we don't have instead of what we do. We think things that hold us back and dampen our spirit. But it's not just about thinking. Our actions matter. It takes conscious, consistent, and creative effort to make a life worth living. This podcast is about how other people keep themselves moving in the right direction, how they feed their good wolf.
Problems with stress and low libido? Did you know that saffron has been used for over 3,000 years as a natural aphrodisiac booster? Happy Saffron Plus contains the most potent saffron in the market, plus curcumin and zinc, to enhance mood and improve memory in a 3-in-1 single product that is vegan, sugar-free, and gluten-free. Developed by a world-renowned leader in brain and mental health, Happy Saffron Plus increases happiness and mood, reduces stress, and helps improve sexual function and libido. Happy Saffron Plus delivers hard-hitting brain and body benefits, so you'll find yourself experiencing better memory, mood, and libido. Join the thousands of people who are living better lives thanks to Happy Saffron Plus. Get your Happy Saffron Plus with a special offer at GetHappyToday.com. The lowest price is only available at GetHappyToday.com. Enhance your quality of life, mood, memory, and stress levels with Happy Saffron Plus. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Thanks for joining us. Our guest this week is Dan Harris, correspondent for ABC News and co-anchor for both Nightline and the weekend edition of Good Morning America. In 2014, Harris released his first book, 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Really Works. A true story. In the book, he describes how after a panic attack on national television, he stopped using drugs and discovered the benefits of meditation. Let's hear the interview.
Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Glad that you could join us. I really enjoyed your book, 10% Happier. There's a lot of things that we'll get into as we go through the interview, but I related with an awful lot of it. And I think our approach to a lot of the things that are in this area are very similar. And I was laughing a lot during the book at different points.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So our podcast is called The One You Feed, and it's based on the parable of two wolves where there's a grandfather who's talking with his grandson, and he says, in life, there are two wolves inside of us. One is a good wolf, which represents things like kindness and bravery and love, and the other is a bad wolf, which represents things like hatred and greed and fear. And the grandson stops and he thinks and he says, well, grandfather, which one wins? And the grandfather says, the one you feed. So I'd like to start off by asking you what that parable means to you in your life and in the work you do.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the fact that the mind can be trained. The brain and the mind can be trained. And you can practice for things like happiness and compassion. And that's the radical notion undergirding meditation, that just as you go to the gym and build your bicep, you can sit, close your eyes, and practice things, to be happier or to be kinder or lots of other things. And that there's science that backs this up. And we see it in the brain scans, that we see that the areas of the brain associated with stress, the gray matter literally shrinks. The area associated with empathy and compassion, the gray matter literally grows. So this isn't some touchy-feely, new-agey thing. This is hardcore scientific stuff, and at the same time, life-changing. And this is why we're seeing everyone from scientists to pro football players to entertainers to CEOs engaging with what has always been considered a kind of fringy, weirdo activity. And it's why I wrote my book, to try to get people who might be skeptical about this stuff to open their minds a little bit.
Exactly. And I'm going to give just a brief overview of your book for the listeners, and then I'll kind of go into some more in-depth questions, and you can jump in if I say it, you know, if I don't get the summary quite right. But in general, it's a story of you, your journalism career, you going overseas in a lot of war zones, coming home, starting to self-medicate some different feelings through drugs, which led to you having a panic attack on air, which then led you to start searching for some answers as to what was happening, which ultimately led to you getting into meditation and then writing this book. So that's the very, you know, 45-second version. Pretty close?
Sure. Fair enough, yeah.
All right. So you originally said that you wanted the title of your book to be "The Voice in My Head is an Asshole," which I thought was a wonderful title. You also just referred to the voice in your head as a malevolent puppeteer, which I also absolutely loved. What do you mean by that?
I think that the fundamental truth of the human condition is that we have this voice in our head, an inner narrator. I mean, I'm not talking about hearing voices or schizophrenia. I'm just talking about this voice that is what chases you out of bed in the morning and is heckling you all day long and has you constantly wanting things or not wanting or judging other people or very harshly judging yourself and thinking about the past and thinking about the future instead of focusing on what's happening right now. And when you're unaware of this nonstop conversation you're having with yourself, it is a malevolent puppeteer. It yanks you around, and it's why you have your hand in the fridge when you're not hungry, or you're losing your temper when it's strategically unwise, or you are checking your email when your kids are trying to talk to you. So to me, that's why I wanted to call the book "The Voice in My Head is an Asshole," because I just think that's a profane statement of a fundamental truth.
I agree. I think the first time that I ever got that, really understood that and heard, and you sort of described a similar experience when you read somebody describing that voice in their head, it was a complete revelation that most of us have never really thought of, that voice isn't necessarily us. It's a manifestation of our mind.
The central feature of our lives is this sense of me or I. It's the force that has you making dentist appointments or getting up and leaving the room when you have to go to the bathroom. It's this propulsion that's with us all the time and is, you know, color commentating on everything. But we take it for granted. We don't see it unless it's pointed out to you. And when it's pointed out to you, it's like this thunderous truism. Obviously, it's totally obvious. That's a little bit of a ridiculous statement, but it is obvious and yet overlooked. So when I first encountered this observation, it was a big deal for me. And also, it was not only powerful because it was intuitively true, but also because it explained some of the dumb behavior that you described that I write about in the book, the fact that I went to war zones without really thinking about the psychological consequences, that I came home and got depressed and really wasn't fully aware that I was even depressed. I wasn't self-aware enough to perceive what was really going on. And then I blindly self-medicated with cocaine and ecstasy, and it all blew up in my face in the form of a panic attack on Good Morning America in June of 2004. So for me, seeing Eckhart Tolle, who happened to be the first person who I heard describe the voice in the head, seeing it on a page in a book was a very powerful experience. The problem was with Eckhart Tolle is that a lot of the other stuff he was writing about I found irretrievably ridiculous.
Yeah, I have to say, reading about your experience of reading Eckhart Tolle was one of my favorite parts of the book, because you've got a line where you say, you know, just when I started to think that Tolle was a sage and perhaps he held the key to all my problems, he started saying some ludicrous shit, which just cracks me up, because that's exactly my, you know, when I've read that stuff, I have the exact same experience. It's this, there's so much truth here, and yet everything else that's coming on here is just sounds insane to me. And that's one of the things I loved about your book, Because on this program, we've tried to really be focused on what I would say are pretty practical, down-to-earth applications of, you know, how do we make our lives better? How do we live better in the world? And you come to all this stuff very, very skeptical. You start reading Eckhart Tolle, and you're intrigued and totally turned off at the same time. Tell us a little bit about where things went from there, and how did you go from being so skeptical to being a believer, at least in meditation, like as you said earlier, which a lot of people tend to, has a bad PR program, right? People don't have good thoughts about meditation. How did that journey go for you?
I think meditation has a massive PR problem. I think what clinched it for me was the science. I'm a skeptical guy, but the scientific research into meditation, which I was previously unaware of, is, you know, while it's still in its embryonic stages, it is pretty compelling. It shows that, or it suggests that meditation can do everything from lowering your blood pressure to boosting your immune system to literally rewiring key parts of your brain. And, as I mentioned before, you see it on the brain scans and you see it on the MRIs. And I find that very, very, very compelling. And also, the other thing that I think really convinced me to give meditation a shot is that it doesn't involve all of the things that I thought it involved. You don't have to wear special outfits. You don't have to sit in any funny positions. You don't have to chant. You don't have to light incense. You don't have to join any group. It's a secular, simple brain exercise that you can do, a couple minutes a day, and it can have a pretty transformative effect. Again, there's a reason why I called the book 10% Happier. It's not going to, transform your life into nonstop rainbows and unicorns, but I think it does. What it does is it allows you to feed the right wolf repeatedly. I mean, that's what you're practicing to do in meditation. And, just to expand on the wolf thing, we tend to, the human condition is that we tend to make our suffering worse than it needs to be, and we tend to gloss over or ignore a lot of the good things in our life. And what meditation allows you to do is to be present for the things that are good, and to not go down the rat hole of useless rumination over things that you can't change. I think that suffering and stress and striving is all, part of life and a part of trying to achieve anything and be ambitious. But, what I found with meditation is it's helped me figure out how not to cross the line between what I call constructive anguish and useless rumination. And so to me, that's kind of it plays into the wolf analogy, because there's a wolf that is self-referential and self-absorbed that he gets depressed and anxious. And then there's a wolf that is actually, wise and discriminating and paying attention to what's actually going on. And meditation allows you to feed the latter wolf.
Looking for a healthy, natural mood boost? Boost your health and happiness with Happy Saffron Plus by BrainMD, the 3-in-1 formula for a better you. Happy Saffron Plus was developed by Dr. Daniel Amen, a double board certified psychiatrist and world-renowned leader in brain and mental health. It contains a mix of the most potent saffron, curcumin, and zinc, three clinically studied ingredients proven to improve mood, help support your memory, and decrease stress. Happy Saffron Plus is changing lives. Join the thousands already experiencing a happier, healthier lifestyle. Get Happy Saffron Plus with a special offer at GetHappyToday.com, where you'll find the lowest price available anywhere. That's GetHappyToday.com. Happy Saffron Plus. Make your brain and body happy. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. it can be difficult to get the right balance in our social life. Do we need more contact with people? Do we need more time alone? This can be really challenging to figure out. And one tool that we can use for this is therapy. It can give us the self-awareness to build the right level of social life that doesn't sort of drain our battery. Therapy has been incredibly important to me in the past. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's really easy. I actually signed up for it again this week because there's something I wanted to talk with a specific type of therapist about for a short time. And so I went online, I answered what I was kind of looking for, what type of therapist I was looking for, the issues. It matched me with somebody a few hours later, and that person reached out to me like 30 minutes after that and asked to schedule an appointment. So it could not have been easier. So find your sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/feed today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/feed. I like to make the distinction between pain, which is the normal things that happen to us in life that are unpleasant, and then suffering, which is sort of that, as you just described, it's that extra layer of stuff that we put over top of it, all the thinking we do about what's happening, the feeling bad about feeling bad, or the stories that we tell ourselves around that. And one of the things you quoted in the book, Stephen Batchelor, who's a writer I really admire, and you said, the craving to be otherwise, to be elsewhere, permeated my whole life. Can you tell us more about why you chose that quote and what it means to you?
I just thought, I mean, I really like Stephen Batchelor. He wrote a book called Buddhism Without Beliefs. He's a self-described Buddhist atheist, which is kind of a redundant phrase because there is really no God. There is no God in Buddhism. So, but nonetheless, he's in a faith that is a very skeptical faith, Buddhism, and is barely a faith at all. He's a super skeptical guy. So I like him for a lot of reasons. And he's really good at describing this tendency we have to be projecting into the future or reminiscing or ruminating on the past instead of focusing on where we are right now. It totally actually has a nice phrase here. He talks about the background static of perpetual discontent. That we're like colicky babies. We're never quite happy or okay with what's happening right now. We're always trying to get on to the next thing, or we're idealizing the past in some way instead of fully inhabiting what's happening right now. And I just found the way Batchelor wrote about it to be quite powerful and to be accurate in terms of my life. I mean, I am in a deadline dominated world and of journalism, and you know, so by dint of being in this kind of job, it kind of puts the human tendency to lurch forward to the next thing on steroids. And so I found that phrase very, very powerful. And I'm not saying I've cured myself of that tendency, but the first step is admitting it. And meditation is good for sort of just, you know, rubbing your nose in the tendency so that you can see it when you're doing it and you can back off.
Yep. And I have a question for you related to that. So you recently, I guess within the last year or so, became the anchor on Nightline, which is something you had wanted for a long time. And in your epilogue, you talk a little bit about how that's been satisfying. I'm curious if you think, had you achieved that place without some of the work you've done on meditation, whether you would have had the same sort of experience of being dissatisfied with where things were, what they were, and be kind of looking to the next thing.
You know, I have a conflicted view on this tendency we have to never be satisfied, because I think to a certain extent it's useful, right? Because those who achieve in society often are, you know, like oysters with that little bit of sand that irritates them and that turns into a pearl eventually. You know, you're just never quite, you know, happy. I like that to a certain extent, but the thing is, we take it too far, or I realized that I was taking it too far. And so I don't want to totally demean or degrade the the insatiability of the human mind. But I do think that you've got to figure out how to draw the line. You know, when is it useful to be pushing and pushing and pushing, and when is it not so useful? And for me, I've just gotten better at figuring that out. As it pertains to Nightline, I think about this a lot now, especially with the book too. When you have something, you know, you've probably heard this theory before, the set point theory, that we humans have a happiness set point, that good things can happen or bad things can happen. We tend to sort of gravitate over time back to our set point. And that happened to me both with Nightline. I got the job and I was so excited. And then I just kind of gravitated back to my set point over time. And then with my book, you know, I worked on this book for 4 years and I worried that it was going to suck, and maybe it does suck, but it ended up selling well, which was enormously thrilling. And then over time, you just kind of gravitate back to your set point. What I will say, the difference between the old me and the new me is that I think the set point has gone up over time, and that I'm more aware of the gravitation back to it. And so I don't get too carried away with the ego trip of doing well at something, and I don't get too disappointed in myself when it wears off and I start looking around and thinking about, well, what am I going to do next?
One of the things in the book that you wrestled with, and you just talked about it, and it has been the fundamental question that eats at me for years as I've looked at this sort of stuff, and it's exactly what you just said. Where's that line between always wanting something different and striving, which is undeniably in some ways positive for humans in general, versus sort of accepting where we're at and being happy with that? And I think you did a lot of wrestling with that in the book, where you came to some answers that were a little bit comfortable. Have you had any more insights or anything else you want to share about that? Because that one's still sort of, you know, pokes me in the side.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, for any ambitious person, it is the question, in my view. I think it's all about finding the line between, as I said before, constructive anguish and useless rumination. And that's a blurry and wavy line. And it's kind of like in spin class. I don't know if you've ever taken a spin class where you're on these bikes and
the instructor.
You've taken one or you haven't?
I have, unfortunately.
Okay, so yeah, it sucks. I do it, but it's a good workout, but it's horrible. Anyway, the instructor will say, you know, turn the resistance up to 6. Well, there's no number on the dial, so you're setting your own 6. And that's kind of the same thing here, that you've got to kind of have this internal self-awareness to know, okay, I've now spent 20 minutes worrying about all the awful ramifications of missing a flight. Is it okay now to start thinking about something else? Yes, I think it is. And it's just an ongoing process. But for me, I just find it interesting to watch my mind in that way. You know, that last statement is kind of a larger issue. The fact that when you become a meditator, you sort of objectify your mind in some ways. You start to view it with some amusement and in a more dispassionate way. But back to the ambition question, I just think that it's about figuring out when is it okay to be pushing and pushing and pushing, and when is it no longer useful?
Yep. The other thing I've thought about with that is I've come from a position that always thinks that it's dissatisfaction or unhappiness or pain that drives me forward to do things. And I've thought more about, could that motivation come from a different place, or does it sometimes come from a different place? Not one of unhappiness, but one of, I guess, for lack of a better word, a joy or an enjoyment of making and creating things.
I think it can, you know, and I think it can come from both places. I found that when I've gone on meditation retreats, you know, when the amount of discursive random thinking comes down because you're you know, focusing on your breath for hours at a time, I have many more good ideas. I'm often like running back to my room to scribble things down. And where is that coming from? It's not coming from a striving place, right? It's just coming from getting out of your own way. But by the same token, I'm not against, you know, creating a big ambition for myself or anybody else doing it and then going for it with extreme prejudice. I think there's something to be said for that. And that's how we got the iPhone and skyscrapers. But I also think that enormous amount of creativity can come from more positive places too. It's just not a simple answer.
Right. It's not. And I think for a long time, I wanted a simple answer with it. You did get sort of an answer, and I think it might have been Joseph Goldstein who gave it to you, where you talked about not being attached to the results.
Yeah. You know, in terms of just to get back to your, you know, this not being a simple answer, I think there is a romanticizing. It's in history. You know, you see it from Plato or Aristotle, or whatever, all the way back in time. We've heard about Shakespeare did it too. I don't have all the quotes at my fingertips. Where this romanticizing of melancholy, that everybody who's achieved anything has to be sad and miserable, and that scans to me as excuses. Now, to some extent, I think it's true. There is a high level of correlation between anxiety and achievement, and which is why I firmly believe that a certain amount of stress and struggle is part of achieving. But again, I'm not quite sure, based on my own experience and having spent a lot of years kind of attacking this question internally and externally, I'm not quite sure that if Van Gogh had been slightly less crazy, that he didn't cut his ear off, that he wouldn't have made beautiful paintings. He might have made even more beautiful paintings. And I can just tell you from my own perspective, I feel like I'm doing better work now that I'm less crazy. I'm still pretty crazy. Again, the book is 10% happier. I'm not claiming some sort of perfected state. And again, if my wife was on the phone right now, she would give you the 90% still a moron speech. So I think, and maybe I'm deluding myself, but I think that my ability to focus is better now. The quality of my work is better. The quality of my interactions with other people is better. And so I don't think that somehow being happier works at cross purposes with being successful. I just don't. But back to your question, non-attachment to results. Yeah, that simple little kind of bland-sounding phrase turned out to be transformative to me. The phrase non-attachment to results is all throughout Buddhism, but the person who first said it to me was Dr. Mark Epstein, who's a very good friend of mine and a shrink in New York City who writes great books about the overlap between Buddhism and psychology. And he was telling me that, you know, you can try really hard to achieve things, but you have to recognize we live in a universe that is characterized by entropy, chaos, and impermanence, and you're not in control. And so the route to maximal resilience is to do as best, you know, to work as hard as you can, set audacious goals, et cetera, but to recognize that in the end, you can't be in control of the results. So a certain amount of dispassion vis-a-vis the results is the right way to go, and that'll allow you to dust yourself off and get back in the fray after you lose, which you will sometimes.
Yep.
And I mean, Steve Jobs lost. I mean, he had a whole bunch of, by the way, he was a meditator. You know, he had all sorts of setbacks. All of my, Ted Koppel, who's a personal hero of mine, he had struggles. Peter Jennings, an even bigger hero in my world, was the main anchor of ABC News at age 26 or something like that, and then got fired or demoted publicly and sent off to be a foreign correspondent. He rehabilitated his reputation and then came back to become a legendary anchorman. So this is the way of the world. We're all going to have these setbacks, and you can choose to feed the wolf of negativity and rumination and resentment, or you can feed the wolf of resilience.
Looking for a healthy, natural mood boost? Boost your health and happiness with Happy Saffron Plus by BrainMD, the 3-in-1 formula for a better you. Happy Saffron Plus was developed by Dr. Daniel Amen, a double board certified psychiatrist and world-renowned leader in brain and mental health. It contains a mix of the most potent saffron, curcumin, and zinc, three clinically studied ingredients proven to improve mood, help support your memory, and decrease stress. Happy Saffron Plus is changing lives. Join the thousands already experiencing a happier, healthier lifestyle. Get Happy Saffron Plus with a special offer at GetHappyToday.com, where you'll find the lowest price available anywhere. That's GetHappyToday.com. Happy Saffron Plus. Make your brain and body happy. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
The catchphrase that you started to apply to your thinking is this any longer useful? Because to the point, there is some amount of planning, worrying, thinking, all that that's critical. And I think that line is it useful? And how do you tell that for yourself when it's no longer useful?
As I was saying before, it's this blurry, wavy line. I don't know. There's no magic formula for figuring out when your thinking is useful. It's kind of intuitive. But what meditation does is it boosts your self-awareness, because you're sitting with your eyes closed and watching your mind, and you become, in fact, the part of the brain associated with self-awareness, the gray matter, has been shown to grow. You become better at this kind of self-monitoring, so that you can see, when am I kind of going down a rat hole here, and when am I actually engaged in some constructive analysis.
Excellent. I do think your book was really excellent. I've read more of these books than I am even care to admit. And I loved your book, and I actually got something out of it beyond just resonating with the story as a whole, because your skepticism and your path. I think Mark Epstein was the first person I read that I really went, oh, wow, this really makes a ton of sense to me. But you described when you were on your meditation retreat, how you hit a point where you had, I don't know if you'd refer to it as a spiritual experience, but you had an experience of some sort where your mind sort of locked in and you were ecstatically overjoyed. And you described what that was like. You described how your mind was noting things really, really quickly. And despite all the things that I've read and all that, I had never thought of that as being the experience. And once I did, it was, I won't say I had an experience to the level of yours, but something clicked in me when I started thinking of it that way. Really, about the whole point is to sit back and just watch the mind. It's about watching. It's about nothing else. And that was enormously helpful for me. So I wanted to say thanks for that.
I appreciate it. I mean, I think it's actually about, you know, it's annoying to say this because it's such a stupid cliche, but this whole be here now, being in the present moment thing. But another way to say it is the way they say it in sports, being in the zone. What's happening when you're in the zone? You're totally focused on what's happening right now. You're making a free throw, for example, or you're hitting a putt. And that's what happened to me on that meditation retreat. I was just kind of dragged, kicking and screaming into the present moment for, you know, many, many hours. And that was associated with a big blast of serotonin. And I think that most of our happiness is derived from focusing on what's happening right now. And, you know, there was a great study at Harvard that showed that it pinged people on their iPhones. All the researchers sent out these iPhone alerts at random times to hundreds of people and asked them, what are you doing right now and how happy are you? And what they found was that when people's minds were wandering, they were less happy. And so it goes to follow that when you're in the zone, when you're focused on what's happening right now, you can be really, really happy. And what meditation does is just shove you into the moment. I mean, you are basically you're shoving yourself into the moment by repeatedly refocusing on the feeling of your breath coming in and going out every time your mind wanders. And that can have, if you do it, you know, if you're sequestered on a meditation retreat for 10 days with a bunch of weirdos, you know, and all you're doing all day long is meditating, that can be one of the effects. And that's certainly what happened to me. And when, you know, when I drop all of my obsessive thinking, when I'm standing at a stoplight in New York City or standing in my office looking out the window, I can get just a little taste of that one now and again.
And I think what's really important about that is meditation is a big part of it, but that's available to us really anytime that we choose to do it. And I've found for me that that's a great practice when I'm starting to get swept away with whatever negative feelings, is to just come back and try and notice exactly what's happening around me right then. And it tends to interrupt this. I heard an interview the other day, and I can't remember the woman's name, but it was on a podcast called On Being. And she's studied mindfulness since the 70s, and she doesn't really advocate meditation so much. She's much more an advocate of, hey, you can at any minute just start paying attention to what's going on around you. And I think that's I found for myself that meditation is a real way to strengthen that muscle, but it's not the only place that it happens.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, I know who you're talking about. I don't remember her name, but I know who you're talking about. I have never read her material, nor have I ever discussed this, so I'm going to say something that maybe I'll later regret, but I kind of disagree. I mean, I agree that, yes, she's right. You can drop into the present moment. Anybody can, but it's really hard to do if you don't have this practice. It's kind of like going out and throwing a 50-yard pass in an NFL game if you've never done any practice before. And what meditation does is it just teaches you how to do it. You have a mechanism. It's a really simple mechanism. You know, well, I could teach you how to do it in fewer. As the New York Times reporter had me do, the New York Times tech reporter had me teach him how to meditate in fewer characters than it takes to send a tweet. It's super, super simple. It's just you learn how to focus. And I think practicing mindfulness is tricky without it. That's just my view. Most likely, this woman who's been studying mindfulness since the 1970s is right and I'm wrong, but that's just my view.
I tend to agree. I've not read her stuff either. What it made me think of a little bit was, and you said it when you were reading Eckhart Tolle's stuff, like the ideas were great, but there was no practical implementation plan. There was no way for you to see how to get from where you were to what was being described. And that's, for me, that's what meditation does, is it does strengthen that muscle. The other big one that I come back to all the time is, so much of it, it's a skill in knowing how to do it, but so much of it for me is just even remembering to do it, even remembering. And that's, I've said this, you know, listeners are probably tired of hearing it, but that's why I started the podcast, was to remind myself to feed the good wolf, for example, because I've got a lot of the tools. It's remembering to use them on a regular basis.
Well, the one of the many meanings of mindfulness in the Buddha's ancient language of Pali, one of the meanings of the word is remembering. And that's what the practice of meditation is getting lost and then remembering to refocus. And what you're doing in meditation is just training yourself to get to remember more frequently. And you can do that with compassion. There's compassion meditation, which again just boosts your ability to remember not to be an asshole more frequently. And so remembering is great. And that's why I think listening to podcasts, reading good books, you know, you're just infusing your life with this stuff so that when you get swept away, you recover more quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe the not being an asshole compassion stuff. Chris, do you want to maybe work on that a little bit?
It's my co-host. Yeah. I learned from you the best.
All right. Well, Dan, thank you very much. It's been a great talk. I like I said, I really enjoyed the book. I've read a lot of them. It was one of my favorites. I think it mirrored my journey a lot. And I think what you're doing for meditation is really important, which is putting it kind of right in the mainstream and demystifying it. So thanks for all you're doing with that.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Okay. Take care.
Take care.
All right. Bye.
Thank you. If what you just heard was helpful to you, please consider making a monthly donation to support the One You Feed podcast. When you join our membership community with this monthly pledge, you get lots of exclusive members-only benefits. It's our way of saying thank you for your support. Now, we are so grateful for the members of our community. We wouldn't be able to do what we do without their support, and we don't take a single dollar for granted. To learn more, make a donation at any level, and become a member of the One You Feed community, go to oneyoufeed.net/join. The One You Feed podcast would like to sincerely thank our sponsors for supporting the show.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.